Front Pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Today is Tuesday. It is April 23rd, 2024. I'm Jim McPherson, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times with me today is Kathy Danaher. Let's start by reviewing the photos on the front pages of these two morning newspapers. And in the Hartford Courant, above the fold and across five of the six columns, we have a very large color photo of a group of people demonstrating, one of them holding a Palestinian flag in front of a columned building. The caption tells us that these are Yale students and protesters who sing rally chants as they block the intersection of College and Grove Streets on Monday outside Woolsey Hall in New Haven during a pro-Palestinian rally after about 45 students were arrested from the encampment at Beinecke Plaza on Monday morning. Protesters at Yale are seeking to have the university divest from weapons manufacturers that supply Israel with arms. Below that, we have a smaller picture of two students who are writing messages in chalk on the pavement. These are Yale protesters who write messages as they block the intersection of College and Grove Streets outside Woolsey Hall during the pro-Palestinian rally. And the messages are, "We shall not be moved," and the other reads, "Divest." Below that, we have a picture of two men in suits talking to each other. They are Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney of New Haven and Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff of Norwalk. These are leaders on pushing for a provision barring the use of Chinese-made drones by Connecticut municipalities. And on the right, we have a small picture of a woman who's smiling vibrantly into the camera. She's Enrica Amor, part of whose remains were launched into space in January. And we will cover stories associated with each of these pictures a little bit later on in the program. Moving on to the New York Times, we have a picture above the fold and across four of the six columns of an urban area that has been completely destroyed. The caption tells us that this is the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis on Monday. Palestinians have been confronted by catastrophic scenes after Israel's attacks. And then on the right, we have a small picture of former President Donald Trump. It's Donald J. Trump outside the courthouse in Manhattan on Monday. And below that, we have a group of people who are surrounding a speaker on some sort of a plaza. Protesters at Columbia University on Monday. Classes moved online to de-escalate the rancor. Those are the photos on the front pages of the two newspapers from which we'll be reading. Now for the main headline in the New York Times, let's go to Kathy Danaher.
Outlining Trump's past, prosecutors open trial beneath a global glare. Defense tells jury to use common sense. This by Jonah Bromwich and Ben Protest. Manhattan prosecutors delivered a raw recounting of Donald J. Trump's seamy past on Monday as they debuted their case against him to jurors, the nation, and the world, reducing the former president to a co-conspirator in a plot to cover up three sex scandals that threatened his 2016 election win. Their opening statement was a pivotal moment in the first prosecution of an American president. A sweeping synopsis of the case against Mr. Trump, who watched from the defense table, occasionally shaking his head. Moments later, Mr. Trump's lawyer delivered his own opening, beginning with the simple claim that, quote, "President Trump is innocent," end quote, then noting that he is once again the presumptive Republican nominee, and concluding with an exhortation for jurors to, quote, "use your common sense," end quote. The jury of 12 New Yorkers, who will weigh Mr. Trump's legal fate before millions of voters decide his political future, also heard brief testimony from the prosecution's leadoff witness, David Pecker, a former tabloid publisher who was close with Mr. Trump. Mr. Pecker, who ran the National Enquirer, testified that his supermarket's tabloids practice, quote, "checkbook journalism," end quote. In this case, prosecutors say he bought and buried stories that could have imperiled Mr. Trump's 2016 campaign. The flurry of activity on the landmark trial's first formal day captivated jurors, many of whom jotted notes as they followed along. And it sent nervous energy through a lower Manhattan courthouse as bomb-sniffing dogs, the U.S. Secret Service, and the police patrolled the dingy building. The spectacle was a vivid reminder of the proceedings' unprecedented nature. A courthouse accustomed to cycling through trials of murderers, fraudsters, and felons of all types now had its first former president. On Monday, the proceedings ended early with little fanfare to accommodate the Passover holiday and a juror's emergency dental appointment. But it began in striking fashion with the judge, Juan M. Merchan, determining what prosecutors could ask of Mr. Trump should he take witness stand on his own defense. In a victory for the prosecution, the judge ruled that they could question him about three civil trials he lost over the last year, including a fraud case in which a different judge found him liable for conspiring to inflate his net worth and penalized him hundreds of millions of dollars. Matthew Colangelo, a senior aide to the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin L. Bragg, then seized on what he called a conspiracy in the criminal case. Over the course of a 45-minute opening, as Mr. Bragg watched from the front row, Mr. Colangelo calmly walked the jury through the prosecution's argument that Mr. Trump orchestrated the plot to corrupt the 2016 election. The scheme, he explained, involved hush money deals with three people who had salacious stories to sell: a porn star, Playboy model, and a doorman at one of Mr. Trump's buildings. Mr. Trump, who faces up to 4 years in prison, directed allies to buy those people silent to protect his candidacy. Mr. Colangelo explained, Mr. Pecker took care of the model and the doorman, while Michael D. Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer, who was set to be the prosecution's star witness, paid off the porn star. After taking the White House, Mr. Colangelo added, Mr. Trump agreed to, quote, cook the books, end quote, to cover up Mr. Cohen's $130,000 payment to the porn star Stormy Daniels. When Mr. Trump reimbursed Mr. Cohen, Mr. Colangelo said, Mr. Trump and his company falsified internal records, disguising the repayments as routine legal expenses.
Now this headline from the World and Nation pages of the Hartford Current. Court weighs outdoor sleeping bans. Oregon case comes as homelessness rising across nation. This by Lindsay Whitehurst and Claire Rush of the Associated Press. It is datelined Washington. The Supreme Court wrestled with a major question about the growing issue of homelessness on Monday, as it considered whether cities can punish people for sleeping outside when shelter space is lacking. It is the most significant case before the High Court in decades on the issue, and it comes as record numbers of people are without a permanent place to live in the United States. The case started in a rural Oregon town of Grants Pass, which began fining people $295 for sleeping outside as the cost of housing escalated and tents sprung up in the city's public parks. The San Francisco-based U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the law under its holding that banning camping in places without enough shelter beds amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The justices appeared to be leaning toward a narrow ruling in the case after hearing arguments that showed the stark terms of the debate over homelessness in western states like California, which is home to one-third of the nation's homeless population. Sleeping is a biological necessity, and people may be forced to do it outside if they can't get housing or there's no space in shelters, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said. Quote, where do we put them if every city, every village, every town lacks compassion and passes a law identical to this? Where are they supposed to sleep? Are they supposed to kill themselves, not sleeping? Unquote, she said. Solving homelessness is a complicated question, and Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who raised questions about both the role of federal courts and of camping bans, Quote, how does it help if there are not enough beds for the number of homeless people in the jurisdiction, unquote, he said. Other conservative justices asked how far Eighth Amendment legal protections should extend as cities struggle with managing homeless encampments that can be dangerous and unsanitary. Quote, how about if there are no public bathroom facilities? Do people have an Eighth Amendment right to defecate and urinate outdoors, unquote, said Justice Neil Gorsuch. Other public health laws cover that situation, Justice Department Attorney Edwin Needler said. He argued people shouldn't be punished just for sleeping outside, but said the ruling striking down the Grants Pass law should be tossed out because the court didn't do enough to determine if people are involuntarily homeless. Gorsuch and other justices also raised the possibility that other aspects of state or federal law could help sort through the issue, potentially without setting sweeping new legal precedents.
And from the New York Times, why Israel decided to pare down attack on Iran. This by Ronan Bergman and Patrick Kingsley. Israel abandoned plans for a much more extensive counterstrike on Iran after concerted diplomatic pressure from the United States and other foreign allies, and because the brunt of an Iranian assault on Israeli soil had been thwarted, according to three senior Israeli officials. Israeli leaders originally discussed bombarding several military targets across Iran last week, including near Tehran, the Iranian capital, in retaliation for the Iranian strike on April 13th, said the officials, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe the sensitive discussions. Such a broad and damaging attack would have been far harder for Iran to overlook, increasing the chances of a forceful Iranian counterattack that could have brought the Middle East to the brink of a major regional conflict. In the end, after President Biden, along with the British and German foreign ministers, urged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prevent a wider war, Israel opted for a more limited strike on Friday that avoided significant damage, diminishing the likelihood of an escalation, at least for now. Still, in the view of Israeli officials, the attack showed Iran the breadth and sophistication of Israel's military arsenal. Instead of sending jet fighters into Iranian airspace, Israel fired a small number of missiles from aircraft positioned several hundred miles west of it on Friday, according to the Israeli officials and two senior Western officials briefed on the attack. Israel also sent small attack drones, known as quadcopters, to infuse Iranian air defenses, according to the Israeli officials. Military facilities in Iran have been attacked by such drones several times in recent years, and on several occasions, Iran has said it did not know who the drones belonged to, a claim interpreted as Iranian reluctance to respond. One missile on Friday hit an anti-aircraft battery in a strategically important part of central Iran, while other exploded in midair, the official said. One Israeli official said that the Israeli Air Force intentionally destroyed the second missile once it became clear that the first had reached its target, to avoid causing too much damage. One Western official said it was possible the missile had simply malfunctioned. The official said Israel's intention was to allow Iran to move on without responding in kind, while signaling that Israel had developed the ability to strike Iran without entering its airspace or even setting off its air defense batteries. Israel also hoped to show that it could hit those batteries in a part of central Iran that houses several major nuclear facilities, including an uranium enrichment site in Natanz, hinting that it could also have reached those facilities if it had tried.
Back to the Hartford Current now for this headline. Pro-Palestinian protests sweep college campuses. This by Nick Perry, Michelle Price, and Dave Collins of the Associated Press. It is datelined New York. Columbia University canceled in-person classes, dozens of protesters were arrested at Yale, and the gates to Harvard Yard were closed to the public Monday, as some of the most prestigious U.S. universities sought to defuse campus tensions over Israel's war with Hamas. The various actions followed the arrest last week of more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators who had camped out on Columbia's Green, as schools struggle to draw the line between allowing free expression while maintaining a safe and inclusive campus. In addition to the demonstrations at the Ivy League schools, pro-Palestinian encampments have sprouted up on other campuses, including the University of Michigan, New York University, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The protests have pitted students against one another, with pro-Palestinian students demanding that their schools condemn Israel's assault on Gaza and divest from companies that sell weapons to Israel. Some Jewish students, meanwhile, say much of the criticism of Israel has veered into anti-Semitism and made them feel unsafe, and point out that Hamas is still holding hostages taken during the group's October 7th invasion. Tensions remained high Monday at Columbia in New York City, where the campus gates were locked to anyone without a school ID, and where protests broke out on campus and outside. Representative Kathy Manning, a Democrat from North Carolina, who is visiting Columbia with three other Jewish members of Congress to view the encampment, told reporters after meeting with students from the Jewish Law Students Association that there was, quote, an enormous encampment of people, unquote, who had taken up about a third of the green. Quoting again, we saw signs indicating that Israel should be destroyed, unquote, she said after leaving the Morningside Heights campus. A woman inside the campus gates led about two dozen protesters on the street outside in a chant of, quote, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, unquote, a charged phrase that can mean vastly different things to different groups. A small group of pro-Israel counter-demonstrators protested nearby. University President Manoush Shafik said in a message to the school community Monday that she was deeply saddened by what was happening on campus. Quote, to de-escalate the rancor and give us a chance to consider next steps, I am announcing that all classes will be held virtually on Monday, unquote, Shafik wrote, noting that faculty and staff should work remotely when possible and that students who don't live on campus should stay away.
And from the New York Times, in war's ruin, a stark reality is taking form. This by Julian E. Barnes, Adam Goldman, Eric Schmidt, and Adam Raskin. Israel's military operations in Gaza have weakened Hamas. Most Hamas battalions have been degraded and are scattered. Thousands of its members have been killed, and at least one senior military leader has been eliminated. Yet Israel has not achieved its primary goals of the war, freeing hostages and fully destroying Hamas. The war and the tactics of the Israel Defense Forces have come at a great cost. Vast numbers of Palestinian citizens have been killed in the Israeli campaign. Hunger is widespread in Gaza, and deaths around relief efforts have generated condemnation. 6 months into the conflict, the question of what Israel has achieved and when and how the fighting could come to an end is creating even more intense global strains around a war that has cost Israel support from even close allies. Israel's own military casualties have begun to climb, with about 260 killed and more than 1,500 injured since its pulverizing ground assault began in the weeks after the Hamas-led terrorist attacks on October 7th. Israeli officials say that about 133 of the hostages taken remain in Gaza, but talks to secure the return of at least some of them in exchange for a halt in the fighting and the release of Palestinian prisoners have hit a snag.
And now from the New York Times, the National Weather Forecast. A storm traveling east across the Great Lakes today will bring showers from Minnesota to New York and Pennsylvania. Thunderstorms may develop during the afternoon across Wisconsin, Michigan, and northern Illinois. Farther south, steadier rain will fall from northeastern Missouri to northern Ohio. This storm will also bring gusty northerly winds across the northern plains, ushering colder air into the region. With the exception of spotty showers or thunderstorms from the Colorado Rockies to northern California, the West will remain dry. Although temperatures will not be as high as in recent days in the Southwest, warm conditions will continue. That's the national forecast. Now the local weather.
Catch up on the editorial and opinion pages weekday mornings at 9:30 and Saturdays at 11 a.m. on Chris.
The forecast for today is sunny with a high near 65. And tonight we'll have increasing clouds with a low around 41. Tomorrow, Wednesday, there's a chance of showers. It'll be cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with a high near 63. And tomorrow night will be mostly clear with a low around 31. Thursday will be sunny with a high near 58. And Thursday night will be clear with a low around 32. Have a good afternoon. Thank you for listening to Chris.
We turn our attention now to business news as the front pages continue and these business stories from the New York Times business section. Chinese company rewires discount shopping online. This by Daisuke Wakabayashi and Claire Fu. When Pinduoduo, the Chinese discount shopping app, debuted nearly a decade ago, the tech giants Alibaba and JD.com dominated China's e-commerce business. Pinduoduo felt more like a gimmick than a future rival. It was a combination of a game arcade, a shopping mall, and a social network. Its main selling point was lower prices for shoppers who were recruiting other buyers to make group purchases. Customers could pass the time by playing video games or earn money by logging in daily to browse the app. Now, no one is taking the company lightly. Pinduoduo is the sister company of Temu, the bargain shopping app that has amassed tens of millions of users outside China, including in the United States, where it is spending billions of dollars on promotion. Americans who haven't used Temu yet have probably seen its Super Bowl ads or Instagram posts. Like TikTok, Temu is the foreign version of the highly successful Chinese company. As its popularity has grown in the United States, its business practices have also come under scrutiny. Members of Congress have questioned whether it is providing a U.S. channel for products that are made in China using forced labor. It has encountered criticism for its labor practices and failure to enforce intellectual property laws. Inside China, Pinduoduo has also been gaining more attention. As a popular destination for inexpensive groceries and household items, it is now closing in on JD, China's second biggest online retailer, in terms of market share. And when it briefly overtook Alibaba as the country's most valuable e-commerce firm last year, Alibaba's founder, Jack Ma, sent an internal memo imploring his company to, quote, change and adapt, unquote, to keep up. Last month, PDD Holdings, the parent company of Pinduoduo and Temu, reported that its annual revenue nearly doubled in 2023, while Alibaba's and JD's revenue grew less than 10%. The company called the result a pivotal chapter in its history.
It introduced Ozempic to the world. Now it must remake itself. This by Eshi Nelson. Lars Fruergaard Jorgensen has a problem. Too many people want what he's selling. Mr. Jorgensen is the chief executive of Novo Nordisk, the Danish drug maker. Even if the company isn't quite a household name, the TV jingle for its best-selling drug, O-O-O Ozempic, might ring in your ears. Across the United States, Novo Nordisk diabetes and weight loss drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, have soared to celebrity status and help make the company Europe's most valuable public firm. It can't make enough of the drugs. Mr. Jorgensen's problem is one of many top executives wouldn't mind, but the success has caught him off guard. Last year, when the company was celebrating its centenary, Novo Nordisk revenue jumped by a third to 232 billion Danish kroner, or $33 billion. Quote, nobody had forecast this growth, no analyst, nobody in the company, end quote, Mr. Jorgensen said in a recent interview at the company's headquarters in a suburb of Copenhagen. quote, nobody forecast a 100-year-old company would grow to more than 30%, end quote, he said, seemingly torn between pride and amazement. For most of its 100 years, Novo Nordisk has been focused on the steady business of treating diabetes, one of the world's most prevalent chronic diseases. Even today, it produces half the world's insulin. But the development of Ozempic and Wegovy has led to a bigger and bolder ambition to, quote, defeat serious chronic diseases, end quote. That includes treating and even preventing obesity, which is linked to other heart issues like heart and kidney disease. By pursuing a much larger target than diabetes, the company expects to lock the door to a multi-billion dollar market with nearly a billion potential patients. In the United States alone, more than 40% of adults are obese.
Truth Social beats rivals on the right. This by David Yaffe Bellany and Matthew Goldstein. After former President Donald J. Trump was kicked off Twitter in 2021, conservative entrepreneurs rushed to promote social media alternatives tailored to him and his supporters. There were Parler and Gab, Twitter-like sites popular among the people who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. Then came Getter, a social media app created by one of Mr. Trump's former advisors. That crowded field has now narrowed, giving an edge to Truth Social, the platform that Mr. Trump's company owns and where he is the main attraction. In March, Truth Social recorded 1.5 million unique visitors in the United States as its parent company started trading on the public markets, up 130% from the previous month, according to SimilarWeb, a data firm that tracks web traffic. While the app's visitor count was minuscule compared with mainstream social sites, it was 13 times the size of the combined total recorded by Parler and Getter. Truth Social's closest competitor was Gab, a hotbed for anti-Semitic and racist posts, which drew 246,000 unique visitors in March, according to SimilarWeb. Andrew Torba, Gab's founder, disputed that figure, saying Gab had about 6.5 million unique visitors in March, but his numbers couldn't be independently verified. Truth Social's performance has major implications for Mr. Trump's finances. When the app's parent company, Trump Media and Technology Group, started trading on the NASDAQ last month, it surged to an $8 billion valuation. Mr. Trump, who owns roughly 58% of the company, was suddenly billions of dollars richer, giving him a financial lifeline as he faces hundreds of millions of dollars in legal bills tied to the civil and criminal cases against him.
You've finished IVF and want to donate embryos. Is there a tax benefit? This by Ron Lieber. The Alabama Supreme Court's in vitro fertilization ruling this year, which held that frozen embryos should be considered children, raised a long list of questions for people worried about their future fertility treatments. My colleague, Tara Siegel-Bernard, and I attempted to answer many of them in February. But a few unusual ones linger for people all over who want to explore every option. What does the law say about what you can and can't do with your embryos? Can you sell them? And if you donate them, say to a university for research, can you take a tax deduction? Straightforward answers to the question about selling and donating are elusive. It is not clear how many human embryos sit in storage across the United States, but plenty of people who put them there worry about losing control over them. Court cases like the one in Alabama, which all but shut down IVF treatments there temporarily, will do that to a person. So will the increasing restrictions on abortion in many states and the concurrent discussions of when life begins. It may make sense to act preemptively if you possibly can, but to do what? Selling embryos seems outlandish, though it may not violate federal law. The 1984 National Organ Transplant Act outlaws the sale of things in or from the human body, like kidneys, livers, bones, and skin, but makes no mention of embryos. All legal considerations aside, there may not be a big market for anyone seeking to sell embryos. Plus, many potential sellers will probably be thinking hard about the feelings of any potential child. And we'll return after these messages.
Just about any time can be the right time to prepare a will. Properly designed, a will can be a way to achieve a number of objectives after a person is gone. For example, a will can provide a source of income for a spouse or a grandchild's education or support an aging loved one. A will can also be used to continue financial support for a place of worship or charity. The experts at the Blinded Veterans Association, also known as BVA, suggest taking the following steps when preparing a will. Take an inventory of your assets. Choose someone to administer your estate. Make sure your will is kept in a place where those who need it can get to it. These and other tips are included in the Will Planner and Essential Checklist, a kit offered free of charge by BVA. To learn more about the organization or get a copy of the kit, visit www.bva.org or call toll-free 800-669-7079.
We turn our attention now to state and local news stories, with most of the following portions provided by the Hartford Courant. And we'll start on the front page for this headline: Pro-Palestine protests lead to arrests at Yale. This article by Ed Stannard. About 45 protesters at Yale University were arrested and charged with trespassing Monday morning during a protest seeking for the university to divest from weapons manufacturers that supply Israel with arms, police said. New Haven police officers assisted the Yale Police Department in the area of the Beneke Plaza, where protesters were given commands to leave the property or be arrested, police said. The protesters refused to leave and were charged by Yale officers with first-degree trespassing, police said. Quote, they were transported to a Yale police facility where they were processed and released, unquote, police said. Quoting again, at approximately 8 a.m., a group of about 200 protesters returned to block the intersection of Grove Street and College Street. The protest is currently ongoing. The New Haven Police Department has no current plans to make any arrests of nonviolent protesters, unquote. Noor Kareem, a sophomore from Michigan, who was one of those arrested, said, quote, it was very brutal. We were all crying. I was asleep and we were woken up by shouts that the police were here. It was very cold. I went out with my blanket. We were all sitting there, singing and crying together, unquote. Kareem said that she was sharing a tent with friends who were not among those designated to be arrested, but they were arrested as well. The arrests began at 6:30 a.m. Quote, it seemed like the cops had a time which they were supposed to arrest people because they were looking at their watches, and then all of a sudden they just grabbed someone who wasn't linked with us because we were all holding arms, unquote, Kareem said. Quoting again, one person was just walking by and they grabbed her, and then she was the first to get arrested, and then they started going into the circle and grabbing people one by one, unquote. At College and Grove, outside Woolsey Hall, students chanted slogans like, hey, hey, ho, ho, there's blood on your portfolio, unquote. New Haven Mayor Justin Elliker said New Haven police assisted Yale police in the arrest in, quote, a supportive role, unquote. Quoting again, New Haven has a long history supporting people's rights to express their views and struggle through very challenging issues, unquote, he said. Quoting once more, what's important is that people are safe, and ultimately protesters blocking two busy city streets cannot happen indefinitely. So we've been asking the protesters to move off the streets onto the sidewalk, and they've been unwilling to do so, unquote. Elliker said if the students continue to block the streets, quote, at some point we will have to make arrests. Of course, we'd like to avoid doing that because ultimately we want to support anyone having the ability to demonstrate, unquote. He said there had been concerns about safety at Beneke Plaza with issues of harassment and someone allegedly being poked in the eye.
Honor, it's out of this world. Woman's DNA shot into space to orbit sun forever. This by Ed Stannard. Enrique Amor, known as Ricky, taught history in Hamden and New Haven schools and loved to travel, bringing her family to Mount Vernon, home of George Washington, and to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston. She was also, quote, very forward-looking, and she was always interested in seeing women be successful and have careers, propelling women to new heights, end quote, said her daughter, Donna Moore, who now lives in Washington, D.C. Enrique Amore died in 2019 at 75. Today, all those interests are combined in an unusual way, as a tiny bit of Enrique Amore's remains are headed into deep space aboard a rocket, along with the DNA of Washington, Kennedy, and several of those associated with the original TV series. It's the Enterprise flight, the first deep space mission for Celestis, Inc., a company that offers families the opportunity to send their departed loved ones' remains out of Earth's atmosphere. People can send their own DNA into space as well. Previous flights have gone to the moon or into Earth orbit. Enrique Amore, however, will orbit the sun forever. Quote, "The launch itself was just an outstanding experience," end quote, Dawn Amore said of the day in January when the rocket carrying her mother's remains took off. Dawn Amore is a big Star Trek fan. Quote, "I didn't expect to feel the sense of solace that I did," end quote, she said, continuing, "We all think of heaven being up above, and she's actually up above. It brought me a sense of peace I wasn't expecting, really," end quote. The feeling hasn't gone away in the 3 months since the launch. Quote, "I still feel that way," end quote, she said, continuing, "I smile every time I look up and think about her, and I think that she's having a great time," end quote. Besides the DNA from hair follicles of Washington and Kennedy, there are small disc remains, cremated remains, of Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry, his wife Michelle Barrett Roddenberry, Nichelle Nichols, Nyota Uhura on Star Trek, DeForest Kelly, Leonard Bones McCoy, and James Doohan, Montgomery Scott. Gene Roddenberry has had his remains shot into space before, according to Celestis CEO Colby Youngblood. Quote, "She would have been thrilled when Celestis announced that they had included DNA from John F. Kennedy and from George Washington, because those were her two favorite presidents," end quote, Amore said of her mother. She also, quote, "loved the idea of space travel," end quote, and was, quote, "very closely following the James Webb Space Telescope development," end quote, Amore said, though it didn't launch in Enrique Amore's lifetime. Amore said she learned in a documentary about Nichelle Nichols that the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. encouraged Nichols not to leave Star Trek after the first season, and that Nichols then recruited women and minorities for the space shuttle program.
Our next headline, builder eyes Canton for project. Pennsylvania firm seeks rezoning for 4.3-acre field to construct four buildings with 100 units. This article is by Don Stakem. The Pennsylvania-based developer that has built or proposed hundreds of apartments in New London, Windsor, Groton, Newington, Brookfield, and Meriden is looking to put up a pair of four-story buildings with 100 units along Lawton Road, just off busy Route 44 in Canton. AR Building Company Incorporated is looking to build on a 4.3-acre field just to the north of Yukon Health's Urgent Care Center at Route 44 and Lawton Road. If the town's Planning and Zoning Commission gives its approval, the Lawton Road apartments would be AR's first project in Canton. The company is deeply entrenched in Connecticut. It has apartment complexes in New London and is working to build an extensive network across the state. Based in suburban Pittsburgh, AR Building currently leases out more than 9,000 apartments and townhouses in a total of 10 states. Rhode Island and Connecticut so far host its only operations in New England, while most of its properties are in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Last June, AR gave informal presentations on two concepts in the Farmington Valley, a 102-unit complex in Canton and a 151-unit version on Darling Drive in Avon. The company later applied for a wetlands application in Avon, but withdrew in the winter and no longer appears to be pursuing that project. This month, however, it applied for a zoning permit in Canton to allow a 100-unit version of its original plan. The project would still be built in two buildings with a total of about 97,000 square feet, with a mix of one- and two-bedroom apartments. The complex would have an in-ground pool and clubhouse, and each building would have a fitness center according to the application. The proposal is to construct one building with 57 apartments and the other with 43. Documents filed with the application do not indicate the sizes of those units or the potential rent ranges and do not address whether AR intends to set aside some as affordable.
Lawmakers look to ban Chinese drones for firefighters, police. Concerns raised about potential risks of hacking and security. This article by Christopher Keating. Concerned about potential hacking, a key legislative committee voted Monday for a bill prohibiting Connecticut towns and state agencies from purchasing Chinese and Russian-made drones in the future. The Judiciary Committee split largely along party lines, with Democrats in favor of the provision and Republicans against. As the bill has been rewritten recently and is still undergoing revisions, the complete phase-out would apply to the state police by October 2026 and municipalities by October 2027. First responders, like police departments statewide, have already spent an estimated $1 million to $2 million on drones, but they will eventually be replaced because the average lifespan is 3 to 5 years, officials said. The problem, lawmakers said, is that the Chinese-made drones are generally cheaper, and Connecticut municipalities have been buying them because of the lower cost. The issue came to light when the FBI and a federal entity known as the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency released warnings that the drones might be a security risk because they could collect video and photographs of water and sewage plants, emergency communication systems, and key infrastructure. Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff, a Norwalk Democrat, has become a leader on the issue because he serves on the Cybersecurity Task Force of the National Conference of State Legislatures. In the recent Congress, where lawmakers remained deadlocked on most issues, legislators passed a law last year that bans the use of foreign drones for the military and the U.S. government. Quote, "Most people are unaware of the risk that these foreign-made drones present in our communities," end quote, Duff told The Current in an interview Monday, continuing, "They don't know. When people get drones, they go for the lowest price, and the lowest price is the Chinese drones, and that's on purpose. But there is an inherent danger," end quote. Besides the federal ban, Connecticut would be following the lead of states like Florida, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Mississippi that have banned the devices.
Man accused of stabbing person outside smoke shop is our next headline. Victim and others allegedly refused to give suspect money, according to police. This by Justin Musinski. A man was arrested over the weekend for allegedly stabbing someone outside a smoke shop in Bridgeport, where multiple people had refused to give him money, police said. David Raphael, 24, of Bridgeport, was taken into custody at a train station on Water Street, where officers found he had what appeared to be blood on his clothing and a knife, according to Captain Kevin Gilleran of the Bridgeport Police Department. He faces one count of first-degree assault. The stabbing was initially misreported as a shooting at 9:15 p.m., when officers responded to unconfirmed reports of someone being shot near the intersection of Middle and John Street, Gilleran said in a statement. When officers arrived, they learned that someone had been stabbed and was on the way to the hospital in a private vehicle. Gilleran said police quickly confirmed no one had been shot. Officers began searching the downtown area for a suspect and secured a crime scene outside the G Smoke Shop at 7 Middle Street. Around the same time, a 32-year-old Bridgeport man arrived at an area hospital suffering from a stab wound to his chest, Gilleran said. Police officers outside the hospital helped get the victim to the emergency room, where he was treated and listed in stable condition. While canvassing the downtown area, police spotted a man who matched the description of the suspect, Gilleran said. He was seen entering the Bridgeport train station at 525 Water Street. According to Gilleran, officers saw a blood-like substance on his clothing and followed him into the bathroom. He was detained and later identified as Raphael. Gilleran said police found he had a knife. The Metropolitan Transit Authority police were notified of the arrest and assisted with the follow-up investigation. And we'll continue, but first, this message.
Hi, I'm Mario Cajar, a Chris Radio volunteer, inviting you to join the Connecticut Lions for their 17th annual Visually Impaired Persons Fishing Tournament. The junior division, for children 3 to 18 years old, will be held Sunday, April 28th at Sage Park Pond in Berlin. Registration and breakfast begins at 8:30 a.m., fishing at 9, followed by lunch and an awards presentation. Breakfast, lunch, and all fishing equipment will be provided at no charge by the Berlin Lions. Applications are due by April 6th, so don't delay. Get your application in today for this fun day with friends and fishing. The Senior Division Tournament will be held Monday, May 20th, and again this year you'll be heading out to sea from Niantic aboard the Blackhawk Sport Fishing Charter, going for fluke, porgy, or whatever else is biting. Registration deadline for the Senior Division is April the 27th.
For more information and applications, call Laurie Satkowski at 860-250-4663. That's 860-250-4663. Or email Laurie at Satkowski@sbcglobal.net.
We continue with our emphasis on state and local news, and we go to this headline. It's just good food. Customers are willing to wait an hour or more at Family Restaurant in Waterbury. This by Sean Krofsik, special to The Current. It's a Connecticut family business. And Labori China has been a dining hub for Waterbury since opening last July. The Latin Asian fusion food at the restaurant located at 105 Meriden Road is in such demand that crowds are waiting outside on the weekends for as long as an hour and a half to get a stuffed plate of steaming hot, freshly prepared food. Patricia Law Lee, 38, is the owner, and she runs the business with her parents and several other family members. The family is originally from China and moved to Puerto Rico 40 years ago. Law Lee has been in Waterbury for the past 15 years, and she initially started her business, a successful food truck, on West Main Street. The lines snaked around the parking lot, she said. Quote, I started out doing my own catering, and a lot of people learned about my food, unquote, Law Lee said. Quoting again, people always told me I needed to open my own restaurant because people don't make food like this around here, unquote. Law Lee said the most popular dishes are pepper steak, fried pork chunks, and boneless spare ribs priced at $13.99, respectively. Law Lee said mofongo, which uses plantains, its main ingredient, is another popular choice among regulars. Quote, we are unique, unquote, Law Lee said. Quoting again, we're not a regular Chinese restaurant. We have Puerto Rican seasoning. The Chinese restaurants in Puerto Rico are different. The combo plates come with French fries and house special fried rice. That's what we have here, unquote. The family has a restaurant in Cagas, Puerto Rico, but lost another one to Hurricane Maria. Quote, we wanted to come to the U.S. and try it out here, unquote, Law Lee said. Quoting again, because of COVID, we weren't sure if it was going to happen. But with social distancing at the time, we had the food truck. We became very popular. We welcomed people from all over the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island as well, unquote. Law Lee said the first month was hectic. She would open the food truck at noon and people would be waiting to eat until after midnight. The food truck closed in November of 2022.
Derude, a mirthful musical mystery. Goodspeed Opera House has become Victorian British Music Hall for production. This article by Christopher Arnott. You can call it the Derude Speed. Rupert Holmes' 1985 musical, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, transformed the Goodspeed Opera House into a British music hall of the 1870s. The front of the balcony area in the auditorium has been adorned with small portraits and designs in a genteel Victorian style. Antique-style footlights have been installed at the front of the stage, which has been extended so it's deep and rounder. To make way for the performers, the live band has moved to a balcony at the back of the stage. This is more than window dressing. The music hall environment informs the entire production, from the melodramatic pauses, complete with heightened ominous piano chords, to the bawdy comic songs delivered as there were audience members in the cheap seats ready to pelt a performer with rotten vegetables if the song isn't good enough. The songs are more than good enough. Holmes has concocted tunes that sound true to the late 19th century music hall setting, but also work as Broadway show tunes. Liz McCartney, as the bordello madam, Princess Bysock, delivers a relatively dainty rendition of The Wages of Sin that lifted into Rodgers and Hammerstein territory, while the fast-paced pattern song, Both Sides of the Coin, is given the frivolous formality of pure Gilbert and Sullivan. Most of the songs are delivered just as they would be in a music hall, with the performers front and center, acknowledging and sometimes mocking the crowd and setting up their numbers as if these performers are better known than the roles they are playing. That's how the show intends it. Each cast member is playing a member of an 1870s London theater troupe who is in turn playing a role in the premiere of a new play based on Charles Dickens' final novel. Dickens died in June 1870 and had already begun publishing The Mystery of Edwin Drood in serial form, but had only written about half of it and left no clues as to its ending. This is all explained in the musical, which announces when it has run out of Dickens' plot and lets the audience decide the rest. The audience is polled as accurately as possible, and the results of the voting are performed by the actors. It's no small trick. 40 of the 140 pages of the published script for The Mystery of Edwin Drood consists of alternate endings for the play's final scenes. The audience votes on several big revelations concerning the cast, including which of the characters has been masquerading as a mysterious Dick Datcherly, and which of them has murdered Drood, and which of them is romantically linked to another one of them.
Now this headline from the Connecticut Insider. School districts across Connecticut likely to cut jobs, programs in coming months as money runs out. This article is by Alex Putterman. The expiration of federal pandemic relief funds will affect a wide range of Connecticut school districts, resulting in hundreds of lost staff positions and cuts to programs serving tens of thousands of students, a new survey of state superintendents shows. 70% of surveyed respondents said the loss of federal money would affect students at least, quote, a moderate amount, unquote, while only 3 said that it wouldn't affect them at all. Tutoring and summer learning programs are the areas most likely to suffer, the survey shows, followed by student mental health services. The survey, administered by the School and State Finance Project and the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents, was sent to every superintendent in the state, generating responses from 60 districts of varying size, wealth, and demographic profiles. Since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, Connecticut school systems have spent more than $1 billion from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund and other financial relief programs. With that money set to expire this fall and state lawmakers replacing some, but not all of it, local officials have long dreaded the impending holes in their budgets.
Trial begins in double fatal shooting. Police believe a scam is what led to violence. This article by Taylor Hartz. On a summer night in 2016, amid a group of people outside an Enfield Street apartment in Hartford's North End, gunshots rang out, and a 19-year-old man and a 21-year-old woman were killed. On Tuesday morning, 31-year-old Brandon Lettman will face a jury in Hartford Superior Court for his alleged part in the case nearly 8 years after the deadly shooting, which was allegedly prompted by a scam involving fake drugs and a fake gun. Lettman, also known as Killa or Murder, has pleaded not guilty to multiple charges in connection with the fatal shootings of Cameron Cato Mounds Jr. and Ashley Spence, and the shooting of another man, Harold Oink Cook, who survived the gunfire that came after one of the victims and the shooter each tried to scam the other, according to court records. At 7:24 p.m. on June 21, 2016, police in Hartford responded to reports of multiple people shot outside a home at 97 Enfield Street. Spence and Mounds were rushed to hospitals, where they were both pronounced dead. For 2 years, investigators worked the case, chasing down different leads and interviewing confidential witnesses who saw the shooting play out. Multiple witnesses told investigators that shortly before Lettman allegedly opened fire on the group, he and Mounds had both duped each other in a trade. Mounds gave Lettman fake cocaine, who traded him a fake gun for the fake drugs, according to Lettman's arrest warrant affidavit. The lengthy investigation into the shooting began with many possible suspects other than Lettman, who, one by one, were ruled out, documents show. Detectives spoke with Lettman, who admitted to meeting with Mounds for the trade the day of the shooting. He told police that he was at a relative's house on West Raymond Street, allegedly texting Mounds about trading cocaine for a gun. And the lottery numbers for Monday, April 22nd. Play 3 day, 8, 9, 4, wild ball, 0. Play 4 day, 8, 3, 8, 7, wild ball, 7. The late lotto numbers were not drawn in time for this edition. For results, please visit current.com/lottery. Sunday's late numbers. Play 3 night, 2, 6, 0, wild ball, 3. Play 4 night, 1, 3, 5, 3, wild ball, 5. Cash 5, 6, 18, 24, 32, 35. Lucky for life, 23, 24, 31, 33, 40, lucky ball, 10. Tonight's estimated lotto jackpot, $2.4 million. Tonight's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $202 million.
On now to Today in History, and we'll start by noting that today is Tuesday. It is April 23rd, the 114th day of 2023. There are 252 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history occurred on April 23rd of 2005. The recently created video sharing website YouTube uploaded its first clip. Also on this date in 1616, William Shakespeare died in Stratford-upon-Avon on what has traditionally been regarded as the 52nd anniversary of his birth in 1564, this using the old-style calendar. In 1898, Spain declared war on the United States, which responded in kind 2 days later. In 1940, about 200 people died in the Rhythm Night Fire Club in Natchez, Mississippi. In 1954, Hank Aaron of the Milwaukee Braves hit the first of his 755 Major League home runs in a game against the St. Louis Cardinals. The Braves won 7-5. In 1969, Sirhan Sirhan was sentenced to death for assassinating New York Senator Robert F. Kennedy. The sentence was later reduced to life in prison. In 1971, hundreds of Vietnam War veterans opposed to the conflict protested by tossing their medals and ribbons over a wire fence in front of the U.S. Capitol. In 1988, a federal ban on smoking during domestic airline flights of 2 hours or less went into effect. And that's all for this edition of The Front Pages. We've been reading from today's Hartford Current and New York Times. Your readers have been Kathy Danaher. I'm Jim McPherson. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11. And it's available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.